Can I welcome you to the Friends of the Library and welcome this to, I think, the last official engagement, perhaps, of Ray Choate, our wonderful librarian, who's led us with imagination and innovation for the last 25 years. I'm really pleased to see such a crowded room, and I think you're all here because of our speaker. For those of you who know Vic Gostin, of course, he needs no introduction. He's an eminent scientist who's got had the knack of speaking to ordinary people, and he's done that through being an inspirational teacher and university lecturer, but of course through his radio appearances on 891, which he continues now. Next Thursday at 9:30, is it?
10 o'clock.
10 o'clock, his next performance. But he also speaks widely to members of the public. I think I first heard Vic at, believe it or not, the Walkerville Historical Society.
The Reesbeath lecture.
Which was a very exciting occasion. And he spoke about the Gawler Craton, and it was so exciting, I can remember it to this day. But Vic has been an inspirational teacher, and he linked geology, geophysics, and environmental education when he was the head of the school. He's written extensively. And as well as winning the Bruce Webb Medal in 2011 for his achievements, most excitingly, he's actually had an asteroid named after him, which I think is really exciting. Asteroid 3640 Gostin. And because he may be too modest to tell you about this, I'm going to tell you. It was discovered by C.S. and E.M. Schumacher in the USA, and the citation reads as follows. Named in honour of Victor A. Gostin, geologist on the faculty of the University of Adelaide, South Australia, a specialist in sedimentology and stratigraphy, Gostin discovered in the Flinders Ranges of South Australia a deposit, and I have no idea what this means, a deposit of shocked debris ejected from the Lake Acraman impact structure about 300 kilometres to the west. His careful studies of this ancient deposit have provided the first detailed picture of the distinct ejecta from a known large terrestrial impact crater. Now, his expertise has spread into linking in with paleontology and other practices, and he's worked across other parts of the university. But most of all, he's a public educator and a public intellectual, and we're very lucky to have him to the Friends of the Library evening in this week, which just happens to be National Science Week. Who could be better, Vic?
Thank you, everybody, for coming. First, a disclaimer. I'm not a professional astronomer, but I have been trained in earth sciences and in geophysics, first graduate in geophysics, Melbourne University, way back when, which enabled me to spread into the cosmos because I had to do a unit of physics three, which included cosmic rays and climate and weather and other units like that that spread my interest in Earth as a planet. And I've maintained that interest ever since. And I guess it was because of that that I was able to do a bit of investigative work when I came across the volcanic rock in the Flinders Ranges, which was due to a volcano, clearly. Well, no, it wasn't. For 2 years, I believed the volcanic rock layer had to be due to a volcano, but anything else I tried about it didn't work. Its age was far too different from what it should be, etc., etc. It had huge boulders of rock this size in Bunyaroo Gorge area, which must have meant the volcano was close by. There was no close by volcano. Anyway, 2 years later, I decided to go back to first principles. In science, we're supposed to have multiple working hypotheses. You know, we're supposed to think of alternative ideas. Well, what alternative ideas? It couldn't have done this. It wasn't glacial. It didn't fall off a cliff. It wasn't due to a river. It wasn't, et cetera. And all else fails, where could it come from? Up there. Wow. Luckily, I'd heard a talk way back at Melbourne University from somebody who'd arrived from the States who said, all the craters on the moon, bar a couple, are all impact. Oh, somehow in the back of my mind, that must have been embedded. So while I was sleeping or whatever, you know, you go to sleep with problems. I had to write up this thing anyway after 2 years of struggle. The people in Canberra who had volunteered free dating on the zircon grains that we'd, of the volcanic rock that I'd sent there, 30 samples worth about $800, $900 each on the commercial market, but they were doing free because they would cooperate with us. The dates came out all wrong. Until the time I said, but you know, Ian, I've got the answer. It was actually fallen out of the sky and had blasted the rock, which is that age that you give me, out in the Gawler Crater, and the rocks, volcanic rocks, were thrown 300 kilometres to the Flinders Ranges. And that was why you had that comment about the discovery. So thanks to that sort of thinking out of the box, things worked. Okay, now, so having made a disclaimer that I'm not a professional astronomer, I also want to comment that planetary studies have been kind of second fiddle to most astronomers. Astronomers are really out there in deep space, how big is space, and galactic evolution, and colliding galaxies, and the stars of the galaxy, and their ages, and so on, what they do with the explosive supernovae, etc., etc. Planetary studies kind of, I remember being told by a couple of people who are involved in meteorites, and in fact here in physics, they said, really, we can't get the grants because all the big money goes to these super colliders and super telescopes and so on. So, but I felt that stepping in between, because of my background in Earth studies as a planet, I could say something about the structure of Mars and Venus and Mercury and the Moon and so on. So any solid planet, I feel I've got some stake in being able to comment, at least, on what's going on. So now that you know my background, know where I'm lacking. And by the way, on Radio 891, as my wife reminds me every time I leave the door to go to the radio station, to the 891 studio, she says, darling, if you don't know, say so. So you know, friendly wife's advice. So I can't handle what the time does time do in the black hole. And would you believe if some professor rings up and says, I can answer that question for you? So there we go. So I'm offering that to you. So what I've done is to simply keep up to date with what's been happening and share with you some of the exciting things that I have at the moment. And they are very exciting. So what's new in comets? I'm also going to show you some lovely images that we have of the comet that's currently on show, shall we say, and available through the web in various ways. But also, I'm going to say that planets in chaos. I do have a couple of handouts here, but really it's the article is from Nature, the leading article from the scientific journal called Nature, July last year, 2014. And the thing about this is that all our old theories are down the hatch. If you have anybody in the audience who's willing to take up the challenge of creating a new theory, go ahead. Because for the more than a thousand planetary systems have now been discovered, and they're all different to our own. And they're so different that we can't really understand why they are there where they are. So the solar nebula, well, that's still the idea that, of course, we have lots of dust, space dust, a lot of the darker areas, and that contains not only solid material, but also ices of various types, frozen methanes and frozen water of various types, etc., etc. Lots of gases are in frozen state in deep space because of very cold temperatures. I'll come to that later in the talk. So planets in chaos, there's the reference, Nature, 3rd of July. Standard model simply doesn't work. Standard model just has everything coming in together, and basically near the sun you've got the high temperature things, so that the solid planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, have got the iron cores to them and so on, whereas you've got to get past the snow line or the frozen line into Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune and so on to have the ices and to have the gaseous planets. That's the idea. However, in the new systems that have been found, some of the giant gaseous planets are sitting right alongside the star. They shouldn't be there, but they are there. Another feature, while I remember to tell you, I might forget that when I'm coming to the talk about the comets. The cometary discoveries included the mineral called olivine. Now, hang on. Olivine is a high temperature mineral. It forms the sort of green peridot in the gem trade. It's called peridot. But olivine forms inclusions within the areas down Mount Shank and the volcanoes that we have in Western Victoria and so on. They're bombs from the mantle, deep within the mantle, high temperature minerals. So how is it this high temperature mineral is then combined with the ices and frozen things that are there in the same comet? So it must have had a history of backwards and forwards, being close to the star, close to the sun, further away from the sun, and having more than a simple history. So that's where it's at. And I've lived through, and there are geologists in the audience here who'll admit the same thing. When I was growing up, Melbourne University, our professors were teaching us, well, Gondwana, the idea of Gondwana is all a myth. Continents were never together. They're always apart. Oceans are sunken continents. You had Atlantis and the Atlantic. There are marine deposits on top of Mount Everest and the Apennines. Yes, that's true. So therefore, they were under the sea. So it was up and down movement, never allowing to have any lateral movement. And yet, as you know from Hallett Cove, we have the clear evidence that the ice at Hallett Cove moved up from the south, from what is now the ocean. So there we are, this whole change of the paradigm. That's the term I'm thinking of. Paradigm shift. Now, we had the paradigm shift from the time when we had the Earth at the center of the universe, the Earth at the center of the solar system. The paradigm shifted. No. The sun is the center of our solar system, not the Earth. We had the paradigm shift that, well, perhaps we're at the center of the galaxy, of the Milky Way. No, we're not. We're on the fringes of it. And so the paradigm shift I've lived through is the plate tectonic one, as we now call it, where continents have literally moved apart. We are moving apart from Antarctica at 7 centimetres a year. And the reason why the volcanoes are blowing themselves up just to our north is because we're being pulled under by the old crust being pulled underneath the volcanic islands of Indonesia, and we ourselves are pushing northwards away from Antarctica. 7 centimetres a year, so those volcanoes are going to keep on erupting. They're being fed all the time by us, by Australia. So there's our Indonesian-Australian relations for you. Continued volcanic eruptions. Okay. So that paradigm shift I've lived through. The paradigm shift now is this one. Paradigm shift of a whole new idea. It's waiting to happen. So there may be various things that people have thought about. Sorry for the clarity or lack of clarity of this. I wasn't able to get a better image. But interactions where planets which are very close to each other would have interacted with the gravity of each other, swap places and so on, as one of the moons of Saturn does right now. Migration coming in from outside, coming closer to the star, relevant to the star, maybe moving further out. So growth and, of course, final formation. So what we see in the end is now just one of those states which is in transit, shall we say, transitional. So basically, the younger generation will have to look after this. Most of us here are too old to worry about it. But basically, I'm saying there is that whole paradigm shift. Another paradigm shift that I'll come to at the end of the talk will be, is there life in space? And we're getting, I'm predicting a major paradigm shift. We now have tremendous evidence that we have all the precursors to life. All the genetic background is all there in space, being created in space and on planets. So it's a case of finding a suitable planet where Garden of Eden can grow up and become really living. More of that later. Firstly, water is common across the solar system. Water is made up of hydrogen, most common element in the whole universe, and oxygen, which is about fourth down the list or something. So water is there. In fact, we now know that water is being created inside the Earth now. You say, how? Why? Well, think of it. You're familiar with radioactivity and radioactive breakdown. What does that do? It releases protons. Hello, there's oxygen in various crystals, olivines and garnets and so on, part of the mineral system, it contains oxygen. That active proton and that oxygen there can be knocked off and create water. Water is continually being generated inside our planet. That's something new that you may not have heard about. So the question was that I had previous lectures, does water on Earth derive from cometary input at the late stage, so oceans form mainly from cometary material, or from inside the Earth? Geologists would prefer to have exhalations and dewatering and gaseous emanation. I mean, every volcano will have steam and stuff coming out of it. So there's always been that conflict, or that comment. The geologists would insist on having an Earth-generated water, whereas astronomers would say, look at all the heavily watery asteroids and watery comets and so on. That's where the water comes from. So I might have something more to say about that later. Basically, both, the answer is both, and even more so that, in fact, generated from within. So there is water around, and in the early story of Mars, the early part of Mars had quite a lot of clay production. Clays always have OH in them, have the elements of water in it. And then gypsum. Well, gypsum is 2H2O. If you know anything about plaster of Paris and how that works, you know that that's what gypsum is, calcium sulfate, 2H2O. And to make plaster, you heat it, so you remove one of the H2Os, and then you reconstitute it around your arm or leg, which you've broken up. So gypsum is there at the second phase. It's only in the last three quarters of Martian time that we've had the rusty planet that we have today, highly oxidized, highly acidic and so forth and so on. But that's another lecture. Okay. Another surprising thing to me, and it's lovely actually having to create these talks for you guys, because I learn so much. When you give a talk, you learn 10 times more than what you can deliver. And the first sentence there, much of solar system's water predates the sun. Wow. Some interstellar ices survived the formation of the solar system and was incorporated into planetesimal bodies, the early planets. Now, that was quite fascinating to me, that indeed we did have this inheritance. Not only do meteorites have minerals in them which have been clearly those from precursor solar systems or precursor dust and so on, and high temperature formation and so on, they carry on that heritage, is there like a genetic continuation, but also water is part of that. I'm not sure whether it was due to oxygen isotopes or deuterium, hydrogen, deuterium ratios, but certainly there's good evidence that, in fact, that first statement is absolutely correct. Now, if in fact that is so, the formation of a solar nebula, if that was typical, then it suggests, in that last line there, that the most fundamental for life fostering ingredient, water, are widely distributed to all young planetary systems. So it's not unusual, therefore, in modern astronomy to say, hey, this is fine. This is what's there in most planetary systems. You have already water present in various forms, liquid and solid and gaseous and so on. This is what I've actually told you, so I can skip along. Basically, the discovered of previously unknown geochemical pathway by which the Earth can get water in its interior for billions of years and still release small amounts. And that's simply the evidence that radioactive breakdown produces protons, which are hydrogen, combined with the oxygen of the minerals in the Earth, create water. So water is continually being created in small amounts. Cassini. Cassini is one of the an orbit around Saturn, the one of the moons, and the water in Enceladus is the thing. Cassini was named, the rings of Saturn are named after Cassini. So there was a NASA probe which named Cassini, which was sent out to examine not only Saturn but also the moons of Saturn, one of them being this one here. And guess what they found? They found there was geysers spouting all over the surface there. And not only that, the geysers were actually taking up some silicate elements which were analyzed by the probes, as now the dust circulating around Saturn contained silicates. Where did these silicates come from? Well, the idea is that fumaroles inside the water under the ice cap of the planet gives rise to the water. Fumaroles carry elements of silicates which then spew out and captured by the rings of Saturn, and that's where the analysis took place. So they've worked back to the system that methane is produced by hydrothermal processes at the rock-water boundary, the bottom of the ocean underneath the moon, and this is expelled into the atmosphere and then picked up outside. So this has opened up a whole new area of possibility for life. In other words, in the past you had the Goldilocks zone, you might have heard about. Goldilocks zone being that orbit in the planetary system which is just right. Goldilocks being just right, so Venus is too hot, Mars is too cold, Earth is just right, but you know, where your liquid water is still present. And there's no liquid water on Mercury, and it's all gaseous or frozen on the gaseous planet. So the just right, the Goldilocks zone, fits us here. But the Goldilocks zone is not the only place where life could exist. We could have, all the elements are here. There's enough thermal energy, there's enough water there underneath the frozen surface of the moon itself. And Enceladus, as I read the bottom there, may even represent a very common habitat in the galaxy. Icy moons around giant gas planets, located well beyond the habitable zone of a star, but still able to maintain liquid water below their icy surface. So a new area has opened up where that possibility is there. Okay, enough of this background, but I thought I just had to give you this new material because now you want to come, you come to hear about comets. So here we go. Comets. Beautiful things to look at. There's one taken at Cape Shank in Victoria, amateurs, and there have been just some gorgeous ones in the last decades with long tails. And while I was talking 891 on radio, and I think Comets One Farmer from Cummins in Eyre Peninsula rang up and said, hey, look what I've got. And he sent in this to the ABC unit, so I grabbed it from there. Web page or whatever, and so this is taken directly from the ABC, thanks to the farmer who, Lester Barnes of Cummins in Eyre Peninsula, who photographed this over his area. And you can see that amazing photograph of the tail of the comet before sunset. Okay, now, the latest mission, European Space Agency and NASA have together combined to work up the Rosetta. It's called the Rosetta Comet Mission. It was launched in 2004 and arrived a decade later. So Churyumov and Gerasimenko, named after the people, two Russians who actually discovered it. The cometary naming is named after the year, so it was 1967, P for alphabetical order, A through to Z. And then the name of the people who actually discovered it. So it was discovered the year 2004, but Rosetta arrived a decade. Fancy having 10 years of travel and having that calculation. I think the engineering is just absolutely stunning. The engineering of this whole escapade is something else. It's the first mission in history to rendezvous with a comet. Not only that, to deploy a lander called Philae to its surface. There it is there. Now, people ask me about the orbit of the comet. Its 6.5-year orbit takes it from beyond Jupiter at its furthest point to somewhere between the orbits of Mars and Earth at its closest. So it's never going to be sun grazing, so it's never going to sort of really disappear because it's already come to the time of being closest. The neck region, and you see those pebble-like shapes, is really, they say here it's bluer, so probably ice. And we mustn't think of these things as solid because they've actually had radio waves transmitted from Philae through to the orbiting orbiting satellite, and the radio waves have shown that the density of this is halfway between dust and ice. very, very light, very, very, very fluffy, if you like. So most of this material would be more like dust and would be easily to be swept around or collapsed and so on. So probably, and one of the intriguing things we haven't yet known, is the size of these things could well represent the early agglomerations, the early coming together of the space junk, the space debris that forms the original solar system. They had enough cohesion there to form material which stays behind while the dust itself is evaporated or blown out by the sprouts of water and gas. That's taken 17th of October last year. The names, there have been various people who have been giving names, and named after Egyptian gods, so the names are very strange to us. And you'll see that the, as I said, the second paragraph, the porosity of the comet means that rock-like structures are in fact compacted dust. Many structures look as if they are formed by gas moving dust around the surface, in the same way that wind shapes sand in the desert. Two instruments. CONCERT is an abbreviation, typical of Americans, they have these abbreviations, I can't tell you what it stands for, but it's something, passed radio waves through the nucleus between the lander and the orbiter, and showed this very, very porosity, very loosely compacted, porosity 75 to 85%. So, gosh, very, very dusty, very just with some icy things holding it together. Now, these are different images. And the names that have been given to these areas are after Egyptian gods. So you've got, and there's some more analysis, the diverse landscape of the comet. And that's from 17th of July, we're coming closer to today's date. So there we have the neck. You might wonder, why is it made up of these two lobes? It's probably that it was once had a whole lot in it, but the central part was more icy and more volatile, so it evaporated, leaving the dumbbell shape with the more solid parts on either end of the dumbbell. That's the easy interpretation. But goodness knows, you can look up the web pages. So it's quite interesting to see the differences of terrains that were analysed. Now, the analysis here is much the same as a geologist or geomorphologist would look at Earth image and say, well, the area here around the Mount Springs of Urdaneta is different to the area just alongside where the dunes are blowing, different to the Stony Desert, which has got this, that, and the other. So just as geologists or geomorphologists would define different areas of our landscape, people have defined different areas with distinct features to them, topographies and reflectivity and so on the comet. This is a comet. It's not a huge solid thing. It has the comet lander Philae used two gas-sniffing instruments, Ptolemy and Cossack. Cossack analyzed samples entering the tubes at the bottom of the lander, kicked up during the first touchdown, which were dominated by volatile ingredients of ice-poor dust grains. That last sentence is absolutely fascinating. This revealed a suite of 16, not less than 16 organic compounds comprising numerous carbon nitrogen-rich compounds, including four, methyl isocyanate, acetone, propionaldehyde, and acetamide, that have never before been detected in comets. So again, this is new material found, which is combines carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen, so on compounds. And there is a web page that you can look up of all the organic-based compounds, carbon-based compounds that have been found in space. I think there's over 500 of them now. So you can look up the web and you can have everything listed under two molecule, two atoms, four atoms, 5, 10, 20, and so on and so on. It's just, the list goes on and on. So that's quite amazing. So we'll come to its importance again in a minute. Importantly, some of these compounds detected by Ptolemy and Cossack play a key role in prebiotic synthesis of amino acids, sugars, and nuclear bases. The ingredients for life are there. Formaldehyde is involved, for example, formaldehyde is involved in the formation of ribose. It's part of DNA. So we don't have evidence for life, not yet. Although, of course, older theories of panspermia, you might recall the theory of panspermia simply says, well, all life on Earth simply derived from impacts and from elsewhere. Life was originated elsewhere and brought to Earth via comets and so on. And that was an idea raised, but no evidence for that was supportive. So what we have evidence for is the pre-life soup, if you like, all the nutrients, all the complex molecules are there necessary, and you've got to find the appropriate planet on which to land it on, and you've got things made. Certainly, as geologists, we know the evidence for life on our planet goes way, way, way back to the early stages. As soon as water was formed on the planet, we already had some evidence for stromatolites, bacteria, life, simple life already on Earth. So that's not a surprise to geologists. But actual life, and my biologist friend tells me, Vic, the genetic code that we have tells us that all of us are interrelated. Everything, all life on Earth has a similar part of the genetic tree, if you like. None of it goes back before the age of the planet itself. So that's just another bit of evidence against, shall we say, panspermia. But you may have heard about it. Okay, outbursts from the comet. August 11th, that's just a few days ago, taken from 186 kilometres, a jet speed of 10 kilometres a second. I think the diameter of that is 1020 metres. The comet reached perihelion. Perihelion is the closest approach to the sun, last Thursday, 13th of August. Of course, in recent months, it's been getting closer and closer, so it's been getting warmer and warmer, and that resulted in the gas being poured out. That's witnessed just the other day, 13th of August, at its closest. Now, let me see if this will work. I suggest you look up web pages yourself under European Space Agency, ESA, it stands for European Space Agency, Rosetta. And that's the key, and there are lots of images there. Now, how are we going for time, Madam Chair? I have a few lectures about ice, because I think I have five of these, and they're very relevant again. On Earth, ice is hostile to living things, but exotic forms of space ice actually promote the creation of organic molecules, the precursors to life. And those dusty clouds that are up there in the universe are the largest reservoirs of ice in space. We're all familiar with the jewels of snow, I mean the hexagonal pattern. And sadly, of course, it's this sort of ice, which we're all familiar with, that destroys cell structure. If you freeze anything, you can't bring it back to life, right? Your cells get broken up. So at the temperature of normal ice, that's too bad for any organic cell structure. In comets, you have a slot colder form of ice, which is cubic, not hexagonal, it's cubic. Even colder still, in space temperatures, it's amorphous. There is no structure. So there's no breakup of organic molecules. Indeed, with cosmic rays affecting the very cold, watery systems, combining breaking up the molecules of hydrogen, oxygen, and so on, of water, and mixing it up with methane, with nitrogen compounds, with some phosphorus, so on, creates very complex molecules, which then remain in that froze, very cold condition and carried in the original space dust and so on. This has been repeated in the laboratory. So this is what I've just told you. In my words, that icy organic rich dust clouds in space form together to form complex organic compounds. And this is something quite exciting. Back in the year 2002, Jeffrey Badder, University of California, San Diego, published in Nature, repeated the experiment of space because they have the NASA laboratories in California where they replicate space conditions for testing flights. And they were able to replicate this. Instead of cosmic rays, which they can't reproduce on Earth, they use ultraviolet light. So the energy provided by ultraviolet light onto very simple methane and water and carbon dioxide systems, after a few weeks or a few days, the analysis proved that you have all these compounds built together. So he was able to replicate what happens in reality out in space. Now, it showed his conclusions are twofold. One, the chemistry of life is robust. In other words, it doesn't just disappear, it doesn't sort of ephemeral, but it's quite robust. Once formed, these compounds stay around for a while and can be transported. They don't deteriorate. But the last line is stunning. The universe is one large organic synthesis factory. The universe is one large organic synthesis factory. And this is by a space chemist who's analysed the material. So not only do we have the astronomical evidence that there are so many varieties of organic compounds in space, as seen through the spectra of infrared telescopes and so on and so forth, but also repeated in the laboratory. So when we come to things like this, then there we go. We really have our organic rich universe. Our organic rich universe. Those were the additional slides I had. And of course, you might have questions to ask about good old Pluto. Leave that. Thank you very much.
Exciting. Thank you so much, Vic. I'm sure there are some questions in the audience, and we have some microphones if you would like to ask some questions.
Thank you for a very interesting talk, Vic. I was intrigued by the irregular shapes of comets compared to the great regularity that we see with Pluto and so on. At what point in the sort of sizing of things and the gravitational forces does the sphere become the more likely shape?
We see this in asteroids pretty well. Asteroids, small ones, are potato shapes and odd shapes and so on. I think at about a scale of, depending on the density, of course, how much gravity there's going to be. So you need that gravitational centricity to create a spherical surface because things will fall off the high points and so on. So certainly 10 kilometres or maybe certain 20 kilometres diameter, fine. You'll start getting spherical surfaces. But as I said, it depends on density, and the density varies greatly. The in another talk I have talked about Ceres and the asteroids, the biggest asteroids, and one of them is quite dense, and it's spherical, it's fine. It's got also density that of the Earth, thereabouts. But another one, Ceres, is very light. In fact, it's mainly ices. So I don't know whether you know, but Saturn, the average density of Saturn is less than water. Less than water. So if you could take Saturn and put it into a bucket of water, it would float. In other words, what I'm saying is that the density is highly variable across the whole thing. In case of Mercury, Mercury is super dense. So it's thought that Mercury has a core, but very little crust left behind due to possibly impacts removing the mantle, removing, so leaving a very highly dense core behind. So depending on the density, so the answer to that is variable, but certainly once you get to 10 kilometres diameter, 20 kilometres, you start getting circularity. There's enough gravitational pull to pull down the mountains, any high points caused by impacts into the valleys.
How does a lander land on a body that is gaseous and full of water vapour?
There's enough density, enough contrast in density for it to do that. One thing they didn't quite know was that the variation in density was there, so it actually bounced. It came in and bounced, and that's one of the problems. It bounced and then sideways landed in a shady spot or something, and therefore stopped transmitting. So, yes, there's a problem engineering-wise, but the amazing thing that they could actually do any landing. But the fact that Rose... What's the satellite? Rosetta. That Rosetta circulates around means it's captured by gravity of the comet. The gravity of the comet is enough to capture that, and so it's in an orbit. And they can vary the orbit slightly, going away and closer, and so on. So there's a bit of control that they have from Space Center to control the orbit height there. But yes, there's gravity around.
Caroline? Thank you for your talk. It was fascinating. I've always thought that the sun was solid. So is the sun solid like the Earth, or is it just a big bunch of gases?
Our sun? Oh, that's a big one. Oh, well, that's a $64,000 question. No, it's got everything. It's huge to begin with. Compared to Earth, it is absolutely huge. In fact, all the planets that we have in our solar system amount to only 1% or a couple of percent of the total mass. Most of the mass of our solar system is in the sun. So with that sort of massive, the gravitational pull of the sun is immense, and therefore in this its center it is a hydrogen bomb going off all the time. Eventually the hydrogen turns to helium, and the helium etc. turns to carbon, and the carbon etc. starts to build up until you get to iron, so that there is a continuous nuclear reaction, the most common one of which is the hydrogen bomb type of effect, so hydrogen turning to helium. But you also have the later parts of the nuclear reactions that will create the other elements until iron. Iron is the most common metal of the whole universe. It's also there because it's the lowest energy required to form it. Anything heavier than iron, which includes a lot of things that we rely on in our bodies, zinc, for example, and the important elements for our own living systems, were due to supernovae. The energy produced by amazingly high explosives, which created super bombs and the supernovae, which then crashed together the simpler iron molecule, atoms and so forth, to create all those elements up to uranium. So in fact, all of us here are made of stardust. Not only that, we can also claim that we all went through a stellar explosion, a supernovae.
Thank you. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
What's the economic driver? Is there a mining opportunity on any of these?
Asteroids certainly have been talked about. Asteroids are likely to be mined in the coming decades. As I said, we're just discovering about asteroids and the variety of asteroids. And as I said, there's a whole... Astronomy is ripe for a whole new paradigm of understanding how they form, so that we can actually forecast which ones are likely to have useful things and others less so, and so on. So we used to think we had that, but now we don't. We don't fully understand it. So we don't have a major plate tectonic theory for forming planets, and that's sad. So the answer is, I'm sure there is. However, the economics of it is something else. And of course, the economics of bringing some of the material back is very different. After all, we do have, on Earth, we have had major meteorite impacts. Sudbury is one. Now, I know that maybe my friend here and any geologist have battled for years to believe that Sudbury is due to something within our Earth itself, and not due to a meteorite impact.
Sorry, can you just tell us what Sudbury is?
Sorry, Sudbury is in Ontario, Canada. Is one of the largest nickel deposits in the world. Yeah. Is Sudbury, and people who have been involved with meteorite impact studies maintain that the evidence is there. It was due to a major asteroidal impact that brought in most of that, but also disturbed the affected various other processes. Certainly all the nickel ore is present right on the boundary, exactly where the impact and the fractures within the basement rocks are the ones that contain the highest proportion of nickel. But that's, as I said, an argument. Geologists generally have dismissed astronomical theories. It took Gene Shoemaker, of the Shoemaker-Levy fame, to prove in his doctorate thesis that the Arizona crater was due to a meteorite impact. People didn't believe. They had all sorts of other theories, that, you know, it was some sort of gaseous burp out of the stomach. It was, you know, there was no lava there at all, so there were meteorites lying around, sure, but for Shoemaker to prove what he had to do, and it's fascinating, he actually went around the margins and mapped it very carefully, and he showed that the margins of the crater were flipped over like that, outwards. You follow? So that the original red, white, yellow banding became yellow, white, red banding. It upside down. The whole layers were actually turned upside down, and I've seen those. I was shown that by Carolyn Shoemaker on the edges of the meteor crater. So that was part of his thesis to prove that indeed it wasn't something generated from within the Earth, but actually had to fall out of the sky as an asteroid, as a meteor, and the explosion was detonated on the surface, on the Earth's surface, to create that. Always you have skeptics, you always have skeptics, and Goss's Bluff in Central Australia has been described as a meteor impact crater, but you still have an oil company drilling in the middle, spending their millions of dollars finding that you just have fractured quartzites all the way down.
Because I think it's a salt dome.
The salt dome, yes.
Thanks very much, Vic. It was a wonderful talk. I'm amazed by your encyclopedic knowledge. Talking about Sudbury, I was a student at the University in Ontario in the early 70s, and we all went off on a field trip to Sudbury. And the INCO geologists, International Nickel, who were active in nickel exploration in Australia, were all telling us about this impact theory.
Yes.
And we're all laughing into our hands and saying, oh, what a lot of rubbish, you know, they're just trying to give people a false lead to discover more deposits. But the characteristics of that at Sudbury were the same as you've described at Lake Akraman and the fallback
tuffs. Yes.
The Onaping tuff in Sudbury and the...
Yes, the melt rock.
And the Sudbury. Cone structures.
Yes, the cone.
And the shatter cones. The fractured quartz.
Indeed.
Stress quartz is just exactly the same. So... Mm. I'm a believer now.
a geologist.
can I just ask, my understanding of comets is that the streaming that you get, the tail that you get, is always pointing away from the sun, in that the cosmic radiation is responsible for that.
I'll expand on that.
Just let me finish my question. But we saw some gas squirts on this thing here, so... What's going on there?
Okay. The gas squirts are just what locally because of the intense boiling, if you like, the pressure.
Internal
phenomena. However, comets will have two tails, an ion tail, ionic one, which always points directly away from the sun because it's the ions from solar wind that pushing it. The tail that we see is a reflection of light from the dust. So it follows the trail of the orbit. So you've got the comet coming in, and the orbital tail will be the dust expelled by the activity on the comet. Will be I don't have a photograph here, but in another talk I was certainly there. You can see two tails. One is a very straightforward one, which is similar to the ionic tail, similar to our fluorescent lights. It's a fluoro phenomenon, excited atoms, excited ions, whereas the whitish, yellowish tail is a reflection of the sun on dust particles and solid particles, watery particles.
So there's no specific orientation.
Well, it tends to be related to the orbit, so it tends to follow. And as comets break up, they will tend to then still be parts of that orbit. They'll just disintegrate and have several things coming in. And we had a phenomenon several years ago, which is absolutely stunning, where Shoemaker-Levy comet crashed into Jupiter. And everybody was watching how 23 fragments of that comet eventually ended up bang, 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 23 times into the atmosphere of Jupiter, leaving behind various scars or various atmospheric disturbances on the planet Jupiter in the southern hemisphere. Yeah, that was quite an amazing thing. So our universe, or our solar system is very much alive and kicking and still very active. So it's just that our own human timescale is so short that we don't realise that the Earth's timescale, I have difficulty with this on radio, the Earth's timescale is very different. It's, you know, measured in millions of years, thousands of millions and so forth and so on. You know, we measure things by generations of 20 years, 25 years a generation. whatever, whereas the Earth measures itself in thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of years.
Firstly, you say water is being produced within the Earth as we speak.
Very exciting.
So you said a little.
Yes.
And I just wondered how much is a little. And the second question is, what are one or two of the surprises of which Pluto is full?
Well, first thing about water, well, I can't tell you the exact proportions, amounts, but depending on the time interval you're talking, enough to fill the Atlantic Ocean for sure. I'm not sure about the Pacific Ocean, but quite a substantial amount. Remember that it's an ongoing process. Radioactive breakdown occurs from day one when the uranium and the radioactive elements, including potassium, you know, so you've got radioactive potassium, uranium, thorium, and they all break down nuclear-wise. They all release hydrogen and so on. Alpha rays are hydrogen nuclei and so on. So you've got that release, and the combination with the researchers saying, but we've got garnets down deep, we've got olivines and silicates with lots of oxygen, and that interaction with these, it will produce some water. So it's kind of a new area for discussion. And it's important too, because in the case of our planet is lubricated by plate tectonics. I really mean that. Mars doesn't have any plate tectonics. It's only half the diameter of Earth and doesn't undergo that. So its volcanoes stay put. Its hotspots stay put, so you have supergiant volcanoes, whereas we have volcanic chains as the crust moves over the hotspot. We have Hawaiian chain and all the other chains. But also, in the case of Earth, it fertilizes our planet because it recycles the phosphates and the nutrients and so on through, and they emerge as the volcanics in Java and Sumatra and so on and New Zealand, and give rise to fertile fields. The fertility of the Earth depends on this continuing activity of volcanic results from recycling. Mars has no granites. Granites are formed only by recycling. Mars has no metamorphic rocks other than caught up some xenoliths or something. So Mars is very different and doesn't have that, but it has an early story of water and, as I said, sulfates, the gypsum part of the story. That's another lecture. What was the next part? Well, again, what on Earth do you find on Pluto? Well, you have a look at the next two slides. You see, I've got it all prepared, haven't I? There we go. I mean, you've got areas here with this sort of structure which suggests some sort of a bubbling up, some sort of a convection cells, smooth and non-pitted, whereas you've got an old terrain up here with lots of pits. Yes, you know, this was something really unexpected.
But it's stony in as well, isn't it?
Yes.
When it would be expected to be gaseous or icy. Yeah.
It does have an atmosphere. There is some atmosphere to Pluto. Yes. Well, there we are. Images revealed hazes up to 130 kilometres above Pluto's surface. The atmosphere consists of two layers, 180, another 150. The hazes detected in this image are key elements in creating the complex hydrocarbon compounds that give Pluto's surface its reddish hue. So, for goodness sake, they really don't know. There's some sky. There's Earth's moon, there's Pluto, there's Ceres, there's Vesta, and that's the sort of relative scales to make you think. So why on Earth would Pluto, being so far away, still have evidence of activity? Whereas, you know, one would have imagined it should have all gone. No, come on. We are oldies, we have to die with our theories. It's the young generation which will take up without our baggage, and they'll invent new ideas of how we formed.